Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. Thank you for your promptness, even your earliness. I appreciate your enthusiasm. Thank you also for all of the emails that those of you who have sent to answer those two questions and even give feedback on the initial session. I want to begin to answer a couple of questions that tend to cluster around the same thing. I'm going to be talking in our remaining three seminars about the essence of the roadmap system. The roadmap is the acronym for the seven steps to deconstruct the process of understanding a story and a systematic way of constructing a new one. It's really a system of understanding stepwise change and integrating psychology and neuroscience with strategic coaching. Now, our focus is on a wellness story. It could as easily be on a life story, career story, money story, relationship story. Now, can I get you to manage the background noise? You're not hearing when it picks up movement and shuffling things around, but if you're doing anything else, would you please mute star six, but remember to come back off star six when you are ready to talk, because I'd like to keep the line open for discussion at the beginning and at the end. Thank you for attending to that. One of the consistent questions is around motivation, how to get a client motivated, how to help a client stay motivated, to sustain their motivation, and to sustain the changes. I want to reiterate a couple of things that I said in our last session. Someone doesn't have to be motivated in order to change. You've probably heard, I hear this over and over again in the coach-to-coach sessions in CTA training, where someone will say, well, I just need to get motivated to lose weight. I need to get motivated to exercise. I need to get motivated to have a healthier diet. Well, you don't have to be motivated, and to wait for motivation is another way of delaying or postponing. All you have to have is a plan and to stick to that plan. So those are the only two things are needed. Now, that's where we come in as a coach. We help someone develop a plan. When someone has a goal, motivation tends to crystallize. When someone has a strategy, concentration and attention will enhance. So what we want to do with our work as a coach is to help someone create a strategy and a plan that is doable. In other words, to look at a goal, to have a goal that's a SMART goal, specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, time-bound, and to have a strategy about getting to that goal, to have initiatives and next best actions. For example, to have three SMART goals and have a time period that's reasonable, such as 3 months or 6 months, depending on what they are, for each SMART goal to have three initiatives. And a time frame for an initiative would be around 2 weeks. And for each initiative to have a next best action, something that you began to do in the next 24 hours that creates some traction. So what you've done is to kind of deconstruct the process to create a stepwise laddering of what you do. And that's one of the things we want to do in coaching, is to shrink the change to help someone get traction and create a model in which they can be effective. Because the most common thing that interferes with that is having a big abstract or a big goal. You know, I want to sit down and write a book. Well, nobody ever does that. Nobody can do that. You can sit down and write a page or decide to write 250 words or establish 1 hour a day that you're going to write and substitute exercise or anything here. And if you do that consistently, then after 1 year, you have 365 pages of a rough draft. So what you've done is shrink the change into something that's manageable and doable, that is a next step, that's tangible, concrete, specific, that then fits into a plan that make the steps go in a specific direction. So what you're doing with a client is helping them establish a model that they can operate on and will have for other things that they won't even need to bring to you in coaching. Now, a key, and we're going to be talking about this when we get to the final step, the last step of the roadmap, the P of the roadmap, and that's program change. The most common reason that people revert back to doing something the way they've done it before and give up whatever they've done different that is in the beginning of change is they don't change their identity. They don't change the model of how and who they are, so they revert back to the default mode, their sense of identity that's not changed. So that's what we want to do in coaching, is not only to help them facilitate the process of change, but also to evolve and transform the model of who they are as they're writing this new story, that this become a part of who they are and part of their current narrative, their identity. And that's what makes it permanent. Let me give you one just simple idea of what shrinking the change would be. Terry Fox ran the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. He was challenged because he had an artificial leg, so he ran a shuffle and a hop. But he managed to average about 24 miles a day and completed the race in 143 days. He was interviewed immediately after the race and asked, how in the world, with the challenge physically that you have and thousands of miles ahead and being exhausted, how did you manage to keep going? And he said, I just kept going to the next telephone pole. Now, that's an idea of shrinking change, and that's what you want to do with your client. Shrink the change to look at, out of this whole number of things that can seem overwhelming, what's one thing that you can do to get traction? That's what we do as coaches, and that's what you can do in focusing on the wellness story of someone who may not know how to go about, I want to lose weight. That's a good idea. They need a plan, though. They need a plan of what that would be, a goal, and steps to get there. And we'll talk more specifically about these ideas in each of the seven steps of the roadmap, and that's what we're going to do these next three seminars. So any additional questions or things that you'd like to discuss right now before we move into the topic for our seminar today? Okay, and I have in mind, and I have printed also some of the questions that you've asked, and I'm not omitting or disregarding them. I want to work them in, and I will come back to them as we hit some places in the seminars that I have in mind that they'll fit even better. Also, I still need you to manage the background noise. I'm hearing the shuffling of papers and the bumping of things. But for right now, since there aren't any other questions, I'm going to go to lecture mode, so we don't have to worry about this. Okay, in this seminar, we're going to talk about the first four steps of the choices of change, the first four steps in the roadmap to recognize, own, assess, and decide what to change in a wellness story. Now, we've discussed the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. We're going to look now very closely at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change. We're going to examine the seven steps in the roadmap process to create a new wellness story. Recognize authorship, and this is all in your outline. I meant to mention, I had a couple of questions. The recordings for these seminars are on the same page on their four ports that the recordings will be placed within the next 24 hours. Same page, you've got the teleconference number. The same page you do, you downloaded and hopefully printed the outline as well as the workbook. So four steps, the roadmap, the seven steps, the acronym roadmap. Recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines, decide what to change, map wellness strategies, author new experiences, and program new wellness experiences and identity. Now, each step is simple, but it's not necessarily easy. The actual implementation of the ideas can be difficult because it requires us to change the way we think about our lives, breaking bad or outdated habits, developing new ones, remaining disciplined over the long haul. The first three steps are about awareness, a systematic way to ask questions of yourself or your clients. So let's look at that in detail now. Step one, recognize authorship of your wellness story. Now, remember this premise. Each moment, we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Every day begins a fresh page. The dramas of everyday life don't simply affect us. They're created by us. Yet, so often, the story closest to us, our own, is the most difficult to know. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past and ending an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story to be in before you can give up the old one. So that means you have to take 100% responsibility for your life. So how can we tell our life and wellness stories to ourselves in order to know which aspects work and which need to change? And I'm speaking of it now as if I'm speaking to you, and I know that you're going to be doing this with your clients. The four principles of recognizing authorship. Principle one, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and results in life. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior. Here's a simple example. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined to a very small space. The trainer ties a rope around its leg and stakes the rope in the ground. The baby elephant will initially try to break the rope, but the rope is strong and it can't. The baby elephant stays in the area determined by the length of rope. Now, fast forward. This elephant grows to a mammoth adult size, 6 tons or more. It could easily break that little rope, but it doesn't, because earlier as a baby, it couldn't. This 6-ton adult elephant is constrained by an assumption based on earlier experiences. Putting a little rope around one leg activates a belief system that determines behavior. Beliefs cue behaviors. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can create different results. Principle two, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, register, and process. We construct our storylines from these premises. So we have to bring our beliefs into conscious focus to assess how well they work in present time. And we don't get what we want. We get what we expect. We always make our beliefs come true. And we each act in a way to teach people how to respond to us. Do a little margin note here. If you have a pen and you're taking notes, look at my blog. My blogs are all archived by title in the right column at just www.mentorpath.com/blog. There's a blog with a title, "We're Always Teaching Others How to Respond." I'd suggest that you look at that blog if you haven't already. I know I've touched on a couple of things last time, but I'm going to reiterate the ones I think are important. The principle three, a new story can only occur by living in the present moment. Social scientists discovered that when you measure people's intentions, you affect their behavior. When people are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they behave. For example, when you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of their going to vote by 25% when they say yes. A study of 40,000 people asked, do you intend to buy a new car? The question increased purchase rates in the next 3 months by 35%. Other behaviors with increased frequency, asking if people intend to eat certain foods, to diet, to exercise. So, state your intentions. Be specific. Write them down. Get a witness or an accountability partner. The stated intention is most powerful when coupled with a specific action plan. Henry Ford said, you can't build a reputation on what you're going to do. And principle four, our minds seek closure and infer causality whether or not it's accurate. There are a number of research findings that illustrate that we find something to make sense of what we perceive and believe, even if it's not cause and effect. These research findings suggest that people can be unaware of the reasons they do what they do, but when they're asked for a reason, they'll readily give one. To create a complete story infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness, but complete can trump accurate. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics to bring closure without ownership or growth, a finish without an ending. I'd suggest you review the exercise in step one, recognize authorship of your story. It's in the workbook, page 1.5, in other words, module 1, page 5, and review the distinctions of plot and storylines. And I'd suggest you complete each exercise in step one before moving to step two, and same with subsequent steps. I believe you'll get more out of our discussion in the seminars if you do the exercise corresponding to the seminars, ideally prior to the seminars. And there's a kind of a syllabus to match and show you what you're doing. Second step, own your story. And here I'd suggest you review page 1.7, Assumptions and Motivations Constructing Storylines. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and then how we process it. It's our software package or sets of software. Adding more information to the millions of bits of data that we process daily, like a new diet or health club membership, will likely not have an impact unless you change the software. Remember last time we talked about that if information were enough, everybody would eat mostly vegetables, work out every day, have a lot of money saved for the future, and we'd all be thin, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. Now, as we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation that I think would be useful. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. Here are some examples of empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to exercise 6 days a week. Limiting beliefs can also create behavior and reality. Limiting beliefs have an effect emotionally and physically. For example, I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. My opinion doesn't matter. Every one of these statements by a client, to me, is a coachable moment. That's why I have an agreement with every client I work with that I can interrupt that person at any point if they make a statement that I think might be helpful for us to examine. And also, they can interrupt me at any point if there's something I say that doesn't make sense or we need to talk about more. So notice that these examples include a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. So, first you have to experience what you do as a choice rather than just the way things are. Similarly with passive language, well, it just seemed to happen. A coachable moment. A fundamental precept of step two, own your story, is whatever you experience, you either create or accept. Now, let's apply that notion by talking about point of reference and a little bit more about active versus passive. The point of reference is a basic component of story writing, and I believe as you're listening to your client. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference. They transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They react to situations they're in. Here are some typical characteristics of those with an external point of reference. Another way to say this, here are a list of coachable moments to get someone to move that point of reference internally to become their own authority. They feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. They feel vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. Now, some of these examples are way too easy for me to say, by the way. When they experience a symptom in their bodies, they medicate it away. That's like turning the warning light of the dash off on your car. With an internal point of reference, by contrast, they see their authority as their own. Their premise is an acceptance of responsibility. Their theme becomes one of effectiveness. They know that, at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. Here are some of those characteristics, and these are what we coach toward. They recognize accountability for their own lives. They are proactive. They plan. When experiencing an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated that result. Then they look for alternatives. And think about it. That's the most basic way that we can describe what we do as mentor coaches with a client. If something's working, do more of it. If it's not working, do something different. When they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. They decide what to change and then initiate that change. They also realize the menu of choices is also created. You choose and you choose how you choose. Now, here's a related notion, because this is how we can listen for a position someone has vis-a-vis their own authority in their language, to recognize active versus passive positions. I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. My thoughts ran away from me. It just seems to keep happening. Each of these reflect a passive position. Each of these are coachable moments to help someone recognize that they're writing a story as if it were happening to them rather than they're creating it in this moment. So, for coachable moments, you have to eliminate all the outs. Remember the anthropologist, the idea of a gun was enough to change everything. So, once recognizing and owning your wellness story, first and second step, step three, assess the storylines and plot. Now, I want to recommend a couple of exercises that you each do. I think you'll see the value. These, of all the things that I ask a client to do in the beginning, which is not very much. I only ask a client to fill out the client information packet on my website, and you're welcome to plagiarize that as much as you would like. And this gets to one of the questions that was asked between after last time, is distinguishing what we do in coaching from therapy or from any kind of healthcare. There is a contract there. I've had vetted by a couple of attorneys because of formerly being in healthcare and a healthcare provider. You're welcome to use that as much as you would like. I'd suggest that you have it checked out yourself, but it specifies what, as a coach, I do and what I don't do, that I don't provide healthcare. I'm not making or giving health-related advice. I am simply a mentor coach. So The couple of things that I request someone to do prior to our first meeting, as we schedule a standing time on a weekly basis, is to fill out that client information component and the contract, and I send them the link for a monthly retainer. Often, I will ask them to do the two exercises that you see on 1.12 and 1.14 as an assessment, usually in the first session. I'll ask them to do the exercises to look at their own ideals and their own needs, and to send me the top three needs and the top three ideals that they have. Ideals and needs are at the core of identity, part of the foundation of self. And knowing this about a client can be helpful for both of us in proceeding to align their needs and ideals with strategies and goals so that all of them is going in the same direction. Because sometimes, and you'll see a couple of examples there, about where a client's goals and their own needs and ideals may be in conflict. So this is the, of all the tools and exercises, the needs and ideals is the one I use most with clients. And I usually keep the three most important needs and the most important ideals that a client has sent me inside the front page of the client's folders. And the significance, as I mentioned, to be sure that goals and strategies align with needs and ideals. Now, part of the assessment of a wellness story is to understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. An example, one woman indicated that she wanted to lose weight, yet she wanted to enjoy live food and her summer free of dieting. There's an inherent conflict there, and to recognize that can help her realign. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's simply a theory or frame of reference. It's the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory, not the territory itself. So, with the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. And we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. And we're often not aware of having them, but just assume that we see things the way they are. But our brains have a mind of their own, and we can be of two or more minds. The prefrontal cortex says, let's set up an exercise program and plan a savings for retirement. The limbic system says, let's have that cheesecake and order the big screen HD TV. Each part of the brain struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. Now, one of the unique abilities we have as human beings is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. This means that we can learn from our experiences and from others' experiences as well. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habit or our thoughts. We can think about these things and reflect on them. We can examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. So if a client describes a particular habit that's been repeated as if it were an identity, well, that's just the way I am, or I'm a procrastinator. Also, that's something I immediately challenge, because a series of choices don't necessarily create an identity or don't preclude a different choice the next moment. So, in your wellness story, is all of you going in the same direction? Do all the storylines of your wellness story advance the plot? Listen also to your self-statement. There's a glossary in the back of the workbook. Look up, when you have time, self-statements. There'll be a little bit more of an explanation. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. Whatever you attribute to others, another person, a group, a culture, comes from inside you as a self-statement. We always perceive and create outside to match inside. So pay attention to what you consistently like and dislike in another. Don't project your intentions onto someone else's behavior. Now, another aspect, listen for repetitions of the old story. Recognizing and owning your story is necessary. It's a prerequisite to assessing changes. And remember this, whatever remains unconscious will most likely be attributed to fate. And remember this too, you're always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious, so it's helpful to make them conscious. For example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self, for example, of overweight or out of shape. Then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. Now, we'll talk more about the art and science of how to structure a visualization. And there's a visualization exercise in the addendum to your workbook. But, and this is, I've touched on this before, over 95% of people who lose significant weight on a diet gain it back plus 1-2%. Why is that? They changed their body, but they didn't change their body image. They didn't change their software. Listen to your body. I'm sorry, let me scratch that and go to a different concept here. Listen to your language in regard to your goals. If you say you're going to try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure. Trying immediately says there's not a full commitment, a potential diversion to other alternatives against failure. If a client says, I'll try, that's... You may think I interrupt a client all the time, which I do. It's kind of leapfrogging along, and it sounds more like a brainstorming session. But I will immediately interrupt someone and quote one of my favorite philosophers, try not, do or do not. There is no try. And that's Yoda in The Empire Strikes Back. Because you know the words of someone who's not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction potentially, by not being totally committed, by creating an out. You know when somebody says, well, I'm going to try to quit drinking. You know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of someone committed. I will. And then build in accountability by asking, by when? Our SMART goals wouldn't have a T on the end. And SMART goals are on page 3.4, module 3.4. We'll get there. Also, just briefly here, before going to step four, listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. You sense it and feel it when you eat healthily, when you work out, when you rest well, at the time and especially later. A huge, delicious dessert is going to taste great at the moment, but the residual feeling and awareness of regret will last far longer and is more cumulatively immense than the immediate pleasure of the great taste. Also reflect on what studies and your experience shows. The major taste impact, up to 80%, is in the first 3 bites. After that, it's redundant. Your body's already accommodated to the sensation. So rather than deprivation, have 2 or 3 bites of the cheesecake with strawberry topping on top. The same principle with coke addicts, the hard stuff, not the soft stuff. They describe the chase of the first high of the initial use. The initial experience is where the pleasure comes. It's just that once somebody's decided to do something, they keep doing it. Remember the Ben Fletcher study. Every bite is a choice. Is this bite in my best interest? Listen to your body. Acknowledge and accept its somatic language. Acknowledge what works and what doesn't. Hear your body speak when you eat too much, when you eat foods that are unhealthy or drink too much. It's not rocket science. Listen to your body. It's sensitive, accurate, it's immediate. Pay attention to the message when you work out, when you feel refreshed by taking care of yourself. Your body makes you accountable. A physical symptom contains the message. Yet, even more importantly, a physical symptom is the message. Symptoms give disguised voice to what you avoid knowing. A symptom is a sentinel of a process that needs, begs to be understood, listened to rather than silenced, respected rather than disregarded. It's a storyline needing to be heard. A symptom repeats until it's listened to. When you listen to whispers, no one has to shout. Somatic language is literal. A pain in the neck, purging something, churning gut, weeping skin, hypertension. Feelings never lie. Your body never lies. It's simple. A psychological symptom answers a question not asked consciously and proffers a story with its own history, dynamics, and meanings. Milrad Paddock said it very simply, it's easier to fall ill than learn the truth. So take care of your maladies. They always have something to tell you. You are the author, not the victim, of your symptom. Now, let's talk about step four, and then I want to be sure and save some time at the end for discussion. Step four is decide what to change. So we're going to talk about change and how to do it. I want to have, want you to have for reference the first exercise in Module 2, four basic inquiries for storyline evaluation. That's on page 2.4. And also have handy the exercise 15 reflections to understand your storyline. That's on workbook page 2.10. A precept for this step. Part of the struggle for people to embrace change is because the methods to facilitate change are often contrary to how our mind and brain work. Despite being presented with ample evidence of how change will be beneficial, most people don't make changes, even when they know it's in their own best interest. Now, to say this again, your identity is not your behavior or habits. A habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. It's a collection of repetitions. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will be harder to change. Again, a coachable moment. People become the stories of who they think they are. And remember the principle from step two. In adulthood, you either create your reality or agree to it. And for this, you have to recognize and own your wellness story. Now, let's look at what's involved in deciding to change. How the brain opposes change. This is crucial, I believe, to understand when we engage change. This is part of incorporating the psychology, the mind and brain sciences with strategic coaching, which is the thing more than anything else that makes it powerful and create changes that last. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. Remember we discussed that last time. Findings from the cognitive sciences can inform how to change a personal or a business story. Let's first look at how the brain opposes change and then how to use this information to facilitate success as coaches. Since the brain has a mind of its own, we need to consider 10 precepts of how our brains work. Each one of these, I believe, will help you in guiding someone to write a new wellness story that lasts. The mechanisms are sort of complex, but the principles are so simple, they're almost elusive. One, change generates comfort. Change generates discomfort. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that we've repeated that have become habits are hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation, to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about the way we drive, the same way to work each day. Because of this default mode, because of our brain having innate wisdom to hardwire things that we do routinely so it doesn't take as much energy, we can think about other things or listen to a book. This default mode is so energy efficient. The brain is amazingly adaptive in this way to grow neurons for whatever things we do routinely. Now, when these habits are confronted and have to change, though, the basic pathways and networks get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this thinking. Think about when the usual way of driving to work each day is blocked. You have to snake your way through the neighborhood. It takes a lot of work. You can't even pay attention to your audiobook. It's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change to preserve the default habit. The brain naturally resists change because hardwiring of routine behavior saves energy, so it opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds and strategy have to lead the way. Ray Kurzweil said, "Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them." I heard him say this in person as he was discussing his book, The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. 2, change creates dissonance. Now, couple this brain inclination to keep doing the same efficient routine with the mind's inclination to see what we expect to see. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. We do this by screening information based on expectation as validation. In fact, when we don't see what we expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. It's an actual location, the brain, located right next to the emotional center. The brain has an innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors, which are simply the differences between what we expect and what we actually perceive. It registers as a sense that something's not quite right. At times, it can be abrupt and explicit. Remember, for example, the experience maybe of absentmindedly going to the refrigerator and thinking about what you were going to be doing that day to grab a glass of orange juice and drink, and then abruptly discover when you took a sip that it was milk. When this happens, neural firings disrupt expected flow and use brain energy. Now, the good news. The brain contains neural machinery in this medial frontal cortex to recognize and to correct errors, to optimize behavior, in other words. This means that these frontal neurons also become active after negative feedback or diminished reward. So it responds to mistakes. Now, this is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or a neural response and print out to change itself. And we'll come back to that as using it as a navigation system. 3, the way our brains oppose change. The brain is a prediction machine. Let me give you some numbers. If you have a pen, if you would write these down. I want to tell you these numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. What's missing? Usual guesses, 3 and 6, maybe multiples of 3. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, so the brain predicts the 3rd rise will follow. Extrapolation, predicting the future based on the past, has been called the most common mistake in investing. J. Paul Getty said that there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. So you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of some jokes. Listing 2 things, then a 3rd non sequitur. Set up, payoff. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. So we need to be sure we predict that we envision the right things. Number four for how the brain opposes change. Behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO, chief operating officer of the company, determining a policy about employees being on time. Which works better, threats or enforcements? The answer, neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show two things. Threats work short-term but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. In other words, both of these focus on the negative. And remember, from quantum physics and neuroscience, we get what we focus on, not what we want. Or also, we get what we focus on even if it's negative and what we don't want. We assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition, kind of like the pushback of a two-year-old. The brain's natural homeostasis says, no way, avoid change. Five, and I talked about this in the discussion, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. And someone may not generate motivation until they set a goal. And I've mentioned, many of the professional athletes I've worked with and the professional actors, they get up in the morning, they go to the gym, but they aren't motivated to do that. They just do it because they know that that's what they need to do next in order to do what's next. Motivation isn't essential. Only two things are, a plan and sticking to it. Six, and I want to emphasize, not a good idea, but a plan and sticking to it. Six, emotions can change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, brain chemicals are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. So it's important that someone regulate and be grounded and centered, so that they're not in an altered state, because that can change the entire software package of what someone operates on. Seven, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, can enhance both memory and learning. The things that excite us, provide a little bit of stress short term, can enhance learning. The time window, though, is about up to two hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things head the other direction. Learning capacity declines. So that means with sustained stress, people make bad, emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy for almost everyone I've worked with, from executives to professionals, regulation of states of mind and management of emotion. Under stress, we do two things. We regress to an earlier mode, and we hyper-focus on the most recent emotional events, the recency effect, and lose the big picture. Number eight about how the brain opposes change, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place, in one position, can get the most entrenched. I see this in working with business succession, with families that have started a business a generation or two ago and have a succession plan for others to take over. Now, this is our challenge as coaches, to open a closed system, to empathically challenge, to strategically perturbate a closed system, begin to look at new possibilities. Now, these last two principles are huge for coaching. Nine, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others create neurogenesis: enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. That's exactly what we do with our clients. We co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bus, nudge. The hippocampus is the part of the brain specifically connected with two things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment increased the number of their hippocampal cells by 15%. Exercise increased the number of cells of the hippocampus by almost 100%. And this has been replicated in non-invasive human studies in London taxicab drivers and University of Medical students, University of Hamburg medical students. And another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis and decreases the number of cells in the hippocampus. Remember the two things, primarily, that the hippocampus functions, creativity and memory. Number 10, neuroplasticity simply means the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. For example, for stroke patients who have a dysfunctional arm. Instead of putting the dysfunctional arm in a sling to protect it, as usual, some studies were done where the good arm was put in a sling so that the people were forced to use the bad arm for things like feeding and dressing. After only 10 days of this therapy, patients regained significant use of an arm they thought would always hang useless and had in all of their predecessors. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby brain neurons to perform the functions of the damaged ones. Now, another example. Not only do zoning laws change in the brain, but the amount of cortical real estate that a body part claims can be changed depending on its use. For example, an expert Braille reader has a significantly greater area handling the finger reading Braille than someone who doesn't. Same for the hand of a classical guitarist, the brain area. Now, the good news here, we're not hardwired for life. With new experiences, and that's exactly what we do in coaching and to stimulate and catalyze that, new neuronal pathways and new networks are formed. New highways to new communities in your brain. And some remarkable new research shows consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. So, in summary now, this is what neuroscience teaches us about change to apply to your wellness story and specifically this step. One, everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can't happen any other way. In other words, you have to begin with where the client is. Can't begin with where they should be or with where you are. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. In other words, whenever a client has a fact or a belief, it's an anatomical reality in their brain. You can't simply remove it or tell them something better or give them more information and think it's going to overwrite what's already there. But it can be done in terms of change as a process. It's an inside job. It's what we do uniquely well as coaches. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. This is why fixing doesn't work. You can't just list four reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange someone's neural network. Four, partly because it's complex and partly because it's personal and subjective reality, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. And remember, prior knowledge is concrete, an actual pathway in the brain. You have to begin with where the client is to solidly understand their story in order to co-create a new one together. So, now this is in your outline, but here are some specific ways to facilitate a change of mind and brain. One, begin where the client is. Two, help them learn more about what they already know. Three, highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks like natural talents, behaviors, patterns, to encourage the practice. Four, don't focus on the negative. Don't focus on mistakes. Remember, focus will enhance neuronal etching. You get what you focus on. 5, correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. 6, let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. In other words, it's not going to help to understand all the reasons and the dynamics of the problems and the mistakes and the ways that people have waylaid themselves. Leave that for therapy. This is coaching. Your clients are going to get better faster, more remarkably so. 8, the brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. 9, you have to recognize and take ownership of your experience. 10, when you write a new story and change your mind, you change your brain. And 11, give attention to a new experience or a new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. A series of small, specific steps strategically planned is more effective than a one-time intensive training, unless there's a follow-up program. Let me give you an idea, an example of this. Some penguins who wanted to learn to fly got together and hired a motivational coach. They went to an all-day seminar. They set SMART goals, visualized, wrote affirmations. After a few hours, one penguin had a breakthrough and flew a short distance. This encouraged and really incentivized all the others. Eventually, by the end of the day, they were each flying around the room. When the seminar was over, they left and walked home. I'm going to put us back, as I can find my receiver, I'm going to put us back on discussion mode for any questions or comments. Okay, we have a few minutes. I'm eager to hear any clarifications or responses or questions to anything we talked about.
Hi, Dave. This is Lori.
Welcome. Hey.
In that last list, number 8 was the brain has intrinsic desire to create novel connections.
Yes.
But on the page before, under decide what to change, it says the brain opposes change and has closure to novelty. Can you explain that closure to novelty is the default, but it has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections?
Yes, this is the duality that we engage every day and with every client, that because the usual experience has been hardwired by our brain, where there's a resistance to change, we want to keep doing the same thing to remain in the comfort zone and not try out something new and create the discomfort of something new and unfamiliar, and the error detection mechanism that says this isn't the usual way of doing things, and there's a pushback. Also, can I get you to manage the background noise? Go on mute if you're shuffling papers and stuff. Now, at the same time, there's an intrinsic desire that the brain has to create a novel experience. Consider this. If you look at an fMRI scan of the brain, whenever someone has an aha experience, a moment of insight, 3 different parts of the brain light up, and someone is vaulted to a new state of mind that is more creative and synthetic and integrative. Each of you have had that experience. When you have an aha experience, 2 different neurochemicals and a shift of your state of mind occur that you want to learn more, you want to continue that insight, that innovation. So this is why we engage clients to have their insights and how it works so much better than giving answers or trying to fix problems or telling them what to do. Contrast that, the 3 different parts of the brain lighting up, contrast that with someone is given information, facts, a directive, an order, no part of the brain lights up. Nothing happens. So it works better to engage and co-create with someone and engage that aspect while at the same time you're empathically resonating with someone to say, I understand the discomfort of doing something different and giving up a way that you've been doing it essentially for a lifetime, so that this duality is always in juxtaposition in terms of what we're doing with clients. This is where we can empathically resonate, where we can guide, and when we can help someone construct a new model. This gets to the programming new identity, because when someone understands how their minds and brain work, that there's a natural inclination to not want to do something new. But when there's change and they see that change is not just happening, but they actively created that in experience, not only the excitement, but the satisfaction and effectiveness that it works and that it works better, this is the shared excitement, the co-creation with a client in moving ahead. So that's an excellent question. Does that answer begin to address it for you?
It does, but it also is a huge challenge. Some of my clients
pay you big money because you can have to change when nobody else in the world can. You've worked in a way to be able to get away with saying things to a client that nobody else in the world can say to them. Nobody in that person's life, and especially not in the executive suite, will be able to get away with saying what you need to say. And look at the title, that title, Saying What We Need to Say, in the blog archives as well. Now, I talked over you. Go ahead. You had more to that question.
Some of my clients really love this brain science. Especially my challenge is always to kind of simplify it as much as possible, and you're helping with that. But some of them really just don't get it, or there's something that shuts them off to learning about this brain stuff. But do you have any tricks to simplifying it for them?
Well, now, keep in mind that what we're talking about and the way I'm talking to you, this is training the trainer. This is not a way I talk to clients. I don't talk to clients about brain science. It's not important that they know how their brains work necessarily. And some of them don't even want to know. They just want to know how their lives can work better, or how they can be a better executive, or how they can work as a professional coach and get more clients and have a better, more effective practice. That's where we want to listen to exactly what the client wants, and to let the client's challenge be where we began. They don't need to know a bunch of this stuff. We do, I believe, in order to be more effective as mental coaches, but it's not a prerequisite that they learn about the mind and brain sciences to affect change. And some of them may not be interested, and that's totally understandable. That may be my interest, but it is not my clients. They're interested in how they're gonna work or perform or achieve or relate in a better way. Now, I'll use all that to inform, because with an executive, for example, it may be really teaching them more about emotional and social intelligence, and specifically about conversational intelligence and how neuroscience informs us about the first four or five words that we say is going to boot up a specific mindset, and they're going to use in the listener, and they're going to use that to process the remainder of the conversation. Now, that's about the extent that I'll go into in teaching someone, but that can be important as a principle to understand. You know, I mentioned earlier I work with organizations to develop internal mentoring programs using the mentor coaching tools and methods and principles, and some of these things are important for people to know, and that would be an example, but that's about as far as I go. I know we're way over time. Please don't hesitate to send me any questions or comments, or any others of you who have responses to those first two questions. I look forward to picking up right here next time, and if there's something we didn't cover that we can discuss, have it ready next time, and we'll save some time at the beginning for a discussion. Thanks very much for all of your interest and eagerness and energy. I really appreciate that. It really adds to the whole excitement and the impact of what we're doing together. So thank you, and have a great rest of the week. I look forward to picking up right here next time. See you now.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Bye-bye.